People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking down with life, I'm fighting and fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Love this song I'm singing, be warned. When you run down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man, you're walking on the crack beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. This afternoon I attended a Catholic Mass said by a rebel bishop, and found that very interesting. And he, in his sermon, it was a very thoughtful sermon, he made a couple of very interesting points. One of them was that at a recent discussion in California, about same-sex marriage, about homosexual attraction and so on, of the 20 participants, make a generalization of what led them to homosexuality. They would have concluded that it was a problem with the family. In every case, according to the bishop, the person who became homosexual or identified as homosexual had problems with his father. Now, not just the usual problems I suppose we all have in relationships. And I mean, no relationship is absolutely ever 100%. But they had problems with the father figure. And the bishop was making the point that to be healthy, a family must have both parts. The mother is the heart of the family. The father is the head, the provider. I know this is terribly politically incorrect, and feminists will be chewing their unpolished nails because of it. But that was the bishop's point, that that often it's something already unhealthy within the family. Now, I leave that simply for your consideration, but I found it interesting. Another thing the bishop referred to was the scandal of what has happened to Ireland. And this was Sunday of the Trinity, Trinity Sunday in the Catholic liturgy. And in this, the bishop was trying to explain the notion of the Trinity, that is, three persons in one God, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost, each of these being a separate person and yet part of the same deity. And he said that when Ireland was converted by the legendary and great St. Patrick, who was actually a Roman, St. Patrick came to Ireland and tried to explain the notion of the Trinity and other Christian ideas to the pagan people. And he used as his talking point the shamrock. And he showed them the shamrock, which is, I guess we call it, a clover leaf. And he showed that there were three leaves, but in one union. Each leaf separate, but unite, tied to the stem and forming one. Okay, and legend has it that as the miracle that was to convince the skeptical Irish, St. Patrick drove the snakes from Ireland. The snakes had bedeviled the place. According to a number of current conservative Christian thinkers, the snakes have returned. Here's a commentary by Father Christopher Petrasco, and it's about the recent referendum in Ireland where the people voted, and they voted overwhelmingly for abortion. Father Petrasco writes, "Children will be killed in Ireland legally, and many are celebrating this fact. To many of us, it isn't a surprise how cruel and jubilant such a crowd can be in its doctrine. Radical feminism, which taught that the world would be a safer place with women at the helm, blaming all their woes on men, taints their own agenda by making their first act of liberation to be the killing of their own children." I mean, it put that way, you know, it really is psycho, isn't it? This does teach us that women and men are truly equal in our victory to do both good and evil. Both men and women voted as such. And there's a picture here of jubilant people, including, I guess it's a man with a t-shirt, braying like a jackass. Yes, they're really happy. Yeah, yes, for killing children. And a woman with a relatively tight pink t-shirt and a huge gut showing, and she's not pregnant. She also cheering. So the snakes come back to Ireland. But where sin is, grace abounds all the more. It's my suggestion that we see these snakes, we're talking about evil attitudes, not people, as a chance for new saints to rise up and chase them away once again through new evangelization. So these are metaphorical snakes. My point is this. Even as the world does some horrible things, it doesn't change God's love for the world. Now is a time to extend mercy to those who will undoubtedly need it after they have contributed to the world's worst Holocaust, as we all need that same mercy. We all need that hope, which tells us that we can be forgiven for our sins. And this, with the truth that leads to loving regret, is what can chase the snakes away again. Well, the good father, I think, has a fairly rosy view of these these things. And here's another commentary that picks up, in some ways, the same notion of the snakes having returned to Ireland, and this was the April 8th referendum. The band Horselips were Ireland's high kings of 70s Celtic rock. There's a spooky instrumental on side two of their underrated fourth album, The Unfortunate Cup of Tea. It's The Snake's Farewell to the Emerald Isle. Listen, and you'll hear amidst the melancholy strains a defiant undertone suggesting, "We shall return." I bought all 12 of this little-known in America group's albums. Strangely enough, years later, I found my newlywed self living directly across the road from and making friends with the producer of Horselips' last several discs and his wife in upstate New York. Steve Katz is the pioneering blues rock guitarist who co-founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Horselip is short for the five poxmen of the Horselips. This was one of the lads' retort, drunken, no doubt, upon hearing someone say, "How about calling the band the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse?" In the Book of the Apocalypse, the serpent awaits as the woman clothed with the sun gives birth, poised to devour her child. That old serpent who is called the devil and Satan, who seduceth the whole world. The snakes have finally made good their return to Ireland. The Republic of Ireland did this year, yield to the seduction and legalized abortion. Ireland's current and first openly homosexual Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, whose Hindu father was born in Bombay, was four and a half at the time. This fellow was living in Ireland. Nearly 3 years ago, 62% of Irish voters legalized same-sex marriage. The referendum enjoys a more than 60% turnout. By an even larger turnout, Ireland had legalized divorce by the slimmest of margins in 1996. The Catholic Church had opposed both, but to no avail. Let's play that clip from the Horselips album, and this is called Snake's Return to the Emerald Isle. I hope we can get this here. Despite it being advertised as a song, I don't hear much of many words, so we're going to move on from here. The Premier of Ontario is a populist, and in some ways has shown good judgment on a number of things, including repealing the carbon tax. He, like all recent politicians in Ontario has been under, major politicians, has been under pressure to attend various homosexual gay pride parades, although they're so insolent, this pushing minority, that they don't call it gay pride anymore, it's just pride. Having hijacked the beautiful symbol of the rainbow, they now want a symbol to hijack pride. Well, everybody should be rightfully proud of themselves and their people, I say rightfully with this cause. But these people are not marching because they're proud of being Canadians, or they're proud of one particular thing. And not to be too crude about it, what orifice they use during sex. Anyway, the Premier of Ontario has avoided going to the Toronto Gay Pride Parade, which is a disgusting orgy where there's full public nudity, not all participants, of course, simulated sexual acts, and general disgusting displays. Anyway, rather than grace that with his presence, Premier Ford chose a suburban parade in York Region. And the Toronto Star today reported Premier Doug Ford marched alongside police in the York Region Pride, well, that's Gay Pride Parade, on Saturday. And he said, he had with him our very left-wing red Tory, and certainly she hates me, the Attorney General Caroline Mulroney, and another local MP, MPP, or that's a member of the Provincial Parliament, Christine Elliott, Premier Ford. He said, it was an honor to march alongside our York Region police men and women to celebrate inclusion and equality. Inclusion and equality. Okay, well, what about Christians? I throw a question at Premier Ford and these other two. Would you march in a white pride parade? Or let's tone it down. A European pride parade. Yeah, right? You would? I doubt it. Why? Because we're not supposed to be proud of being European. Or proud of being white. Which is roughly the same thing, isn't it? No. But you, who apparently are not homosexual, and I'm sure Ford is married, but I think it's Ford. Daughters, and Elliot and is married with children. I know Mulroney is married. I don't know if she has any children. But would you march to indicate pride in being European? Now, presumably none of these three is homosexual or lesbian. Why are they proud? Why would they march with this? Well, they're celebrating inclusivity, inclusion and equality, really. Inclusivity and equality. It sounds good, doesn't it? You know, we include everybody. I'm waiting to see that same spirit extended to Christians. The Conservatives are making, unfortunately, some very big mistakes. Now, he's provincial. I'm actually now talking about the federal Conservatives. And there's a very unusual man who sought to run for the party, for the Conservative Party in the upcoming federal election. And his name is Salim Mansour. Now, Dr. Salim Mansour is a frequent columnist. He's a Muslim, a frequent columnist in a number of papers, and he takes a very dim view of radical Islam, and takes a dim view, oh my gosh, let's get the digitalis out, of multiculturalism, and some of the pretenses of multiculturalism. Well, although he would make an excellent candidate, and for those who these things matter, and they don't to me, but we've got to show we're inclusive, so we've got non-whites as well. I mean, the Conservative Party doesn't have any problem with having non-whites. It has lots of them. But, my feeling is, I'm not upset if a person's a non-white and a member of parliament if they truly represent our people or their people and are qualified. Well, I don't have any problem with Salim Mansour. He is qualified. I don't question that for a minute. Well, anyway, he's not going to be able to run for them. this is what I mean when I talk about bad sense. The Conservative Party of Canada, with its merit to call out the jihadis, makes Dr. Mansour the wrong kind of Muslim. It's incredible. Now, that's not for the Liberals. It's not for the Socialist NDP. That's for the Conservatives. And he was seeking to run in the riding in London
North. Hi, my name's Petra Hess from PetraPix.com. Last year, I was able to make about $300,000 in profits trading.
Well, I'm not going to promote her ad. just trying to get this item up here. we do have our problems sometimes here. I'm trying to get this back on the screen here.
Hello, America. I'm Mark Levin. This is Life, Liberty, and Levin. Welcome.
Nice to see you.
It's a great honor to see you, Patrick Michaels, doctor, expert on all things climate and environment, as far as I'm concerned. A little bit of your background. You're the director of the Center for Study of Science at the Cato Institute. You hold an AB and SM. You hold those degrees in biology, sciences, and plant ecology from the University of Chicago. Pretty good school. PhD in ecological climatology from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, 1979. You're past president of the American Association of State Climatologists. You were program chairman for the Committee on Applied Climatology of the American Meteorological Society. Say that fast five times.
Yeah.
You were research professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia for 30 years, and I'm giving an extensive, background that you have, and I'm giving that to the public, so they know you really know what you're talking about. And you're a contributing author and a reviewer of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. All right, let's get started. Climate change, global warming, global cooling, we've heard it all. What's going on out there?
Well, surface temperature of the planet is warmer than it was 100 years ago, about 9/10 of a degree Celsius.
9/10 of a degree Celsius.
That's all.
Is that a lot?
No, it's not a lot. There are two periods of warming, one in the early 20th century that could not have been caused by human beings because we hadn't put enough CO2 in the air, and one in the later part of the 20th century that either slows down or ends, depending upon whose data you use, somewhere in the late 1990s, only to resume with the big El Nino that covered the news over the last couple of years. So that means that probably about half, maybe half, of that 9/10 of a degree might be caused by greenhouse gases. Because when the planet warmed beginning in 1976, the temperature of the stratosphere started to drop. And that's a prediction of greenhouse theory that's not intuitive. The great philosopher of science, Karl Popper, said, if you can meet a difficult prediction with your theory, you can continue to entertain your theory. So the theory's right, but the application of it is wrong. It is nowhere near as warm as it's supposed to be. The computer models are making systematic, dramatic errors over the entire tropics, which is 40% of the Earth, and it's where all our moisture comes from, or almost all of it.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Who does these computer models?
Governments. There are 32 families of computer models that are used by the United Nations, each government-sponsored. And all of them are predicting far, far too much warming. The disparity between what's been predicted to happen, which looks like this, and what is happening continues to grow.
We know that for a fact.
Yeah, because you can just look at the weather balloon temperatures, you can look at the satellite temperatures, you can look at something called the reanalysis data. They all behave in concert. So they're showing the same thing. And the same thing is a lot different than this thing. However, we need to call the special counsel.
Special counsel?
Yes, because one model works. And you know what it is? It's the Russian model.
So let me get this. So all the government models are like this?
Yeah.
The Russian model is like this?
Yeah. The Russian model has the least warming in it.
And the Russian model is the least warming, and the Russian model pretty much follows reality.
Yeah.
What's been tested over a few decades.
Yeah, correct. You know, if we were rational about this, think about the daily weather forecast. You know, you watch the Weather Channel, they go, oh, this model says that, that model says that. We think this one's working the best, so we're going to rely on that. Well, for climate forecast, we should be using the Russian model, but we're not. We use this big spate of all the other models that have this warming in them that's not occurring.
Why are all these other government models, 31 of them, I guess,
yeah,
wrong? And why do they all go in the same direction? Up.
Because they are what is called parameterized. They're all parameterized. Can I translate parameterized into English? Fudged.
Okay.
The don't get the right answer, don't know the right answer for certain phenomena, so we essentially put in code steps that give us what we think it should be. And the systematic error that was made was the models were tuned, as it said, tuned to simulate the warming of the early 20th century. Began in 1910, ended in 1945, about 0.45 degrees Celsius. Mark, that could not have been caused by carbon dioxide.
Because there wasn't enough.
We had to put enough in. The background carbon dioxide concentration is 280 parts per million. When the first warming started, it was 298 parts per million. If the atmosphere is that sensitive to an 18 ppm change in CO2, we wouldn't be talking about this right now, and we'd be sweating bullets.
So what you're saying is man-made carbon dioxide earlier, the last century, could not have produced...
The early 20th century.
Early 20th century could not have produced this heat. So what did? Do we know?
No. And, you know, the three most important words in life may not be, I love you. It might be, I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows what kicked off that warming. There's lots of theories. One is that it was the final escape from a cold period, multi-century period, known as the Little Ice Age. That's a plausibility, but why did it happen then? But we just don't really have a good explanation for that. But because we forced the computer models to say, aha, human influence, CO2 and other stuff, we made the models too sensitive. And so that's why when you get to the late 20th century, all of a sudden they're warming up like crazy and the reality's down here. It was guaranteed to happen. This was revealed in Science Magazine in late 2016, and there was a paper that was published by a French climate modeler called The Art and Science of Climate Model Tuning. And in it, he speaks of parameterizing, we could say fudging, the models to give, his words, an anticipated acceptable range of results. So it's the scientist, not the science, that's determining how much it's going to warm. A lot of people don't know this, but it happens to be true. And, you know, we could speculate as to why that paper was published right before the 2016 election. I wouldn't want to impute causation, but gee, if...
But I want to ask you about causation.
Sure.
You have 31 governments.
Oh, the 31 different models. Some of
all right,
them
31 different models, the multiple governments.
Right.
We're fudging the numbers.
They're not fudging them.
They're fudging the
model. Parameterizing.
Okay, well, you use the word fudging. Does our EPA do that? Does NASA do that? Who does that for
us? Good question, Mark. Because the EPA was told by the Supreme Court in 2007 that if it found that carbon dioxide endangered human health and welfare, that it had the power to regulate it under the Clean Air Act.
This is the Massachusetts.
That's Mass v. EPA. Well, they produced an endangerment finding in 2009. And the endangerment finding for its prospective climate is 100%. I didn't say 90%. I said 100% based on those models. So if you can demonstrate that those models systematically are not working, you can take down the endangerment finding. And that would be the basis for all those policies that came out of the Obama administration.
Which would mean you don't get to regulate.
Absolutely.
Carbon dioxide.
Absolutely. The endangerment finding is the heart of the matter. And to give you an idea how gung-ho the Obama administration was on this issue, if you listen to his first inaugural speech, January 20th, 2009, it's the second substantive paragraph of the speech is about global warming after health care. 90 days after he finished that speech, his EPA produced a preliminary finding of endangerment from carbon dioxide. They were working on this before he was president. Bureaucrats can't work that fast. And then the final finding was made in December for the climate conference in Copenhagen that was supposed to produce another global warming.
So you're telling us that we have a massive bit of public policy that has an enormous effect on society.
Absolutely.
That's built on, I'll use my word, phony model.
It's built on a house of cards. The models really don't work. And if I could really be arcane, I can explain the mechanism as to why they don't work.
As I understand it.
The models systematically predict that as you go up in the atmosphere in the tropics, which are 40% of the Earth, that the temperature should rise dramatically as you go further up in the atmosphere. So when you get to the level of the jet stream, the computer models are predicting 7 times, I didn't say 7/10 of a degree, I said 7 times more warming than is being observed. Well, why is that important? Why am I boring you with that? Because it's the vertical distribution of temperature that determines upward motion, which means it determines precipitation. And guess what? Almost all the atmospheric moisture that we have around us today in humid Washington, D.C., that comes from the tropics. So if you get that vertical motion wrong down there, you get all the subsequent variables wrong. It's a fantastic systematic error. And again, that along with the difference between the surface temperatures, or rather the lower atmospheric temperatures and what's being observed, that's sufficient to kill the endangerment finding.
Okay, so to the average pedestrian like me, if you get that wrong, what does that mean? You get all the weather models wrong?
You get the subsequent weather wrong.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why, if you look at all these families of models, they predict radically different changes in precipitation from model to model. Well, probably because they got the precipitation initialization out of the tropics wrong. Precipitation's important. I offer you Wilmington, North Carolina, as an example that precipitation is important coming from the tropics. Get that wrong, and you get that wrong.
Is weather getting worse?
No. I love that question, because what you really want to look at, Roger Pilkey Jr. at University of Colorado does this. Yes, there's more damage from weather, because there's more stuff and people and property in the way of weather. So what you really want to look at are weather damages as a percent of GDP. And when you look at it that way, there's nothing whatsoever. Oh, I'm sure hurricanes are getting worse. I heard that on every legacy network during
Florence
and Harvey and all that stuff. Well, the fact of the matter is, there's a guy by the name of Ryan Maui, who's just a hotshot young tropical meteorologist. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. And he tracks the energy in these tropical cyclones. Since we got global records that begin in 1970, and you would think there would be some relationship between that integrated energy and global warming. After all, it's only logical. Vice President Gore says that must be the case. It's not. There's no relationship whatsoever between the accumulated cyclone energy and the surface temperature of the Earth. It's just not there. Now, wait a minute. Why does our government say this? They said it in their last report called Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. They said, oh, there's been a significant increase in hurricane power in the Atlantic Ocean from like 1970 to 2009 or something like that, 1980 to 2009. Well, wait a minute. Why'd you stop in 2009? It's a 2014 report. Because if you take the data after 2009, the increase goes away and it goes back to where it was. Or why did you start in the mid-1970s? Because we have records that are really good back to 1920. And if you look 1920 to 1950, you see an increase that is exactly the same as the one that occurred.
So the information they're providing us
is skewed.
It's skewed.
They're cherry picking.
Uh-huh. And here we rely on the climatologists, the meteorologists, and they become hyper-political. And I want to get back to that as soon as we return. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, you can watch Levin TV almost every weeknight by going to crtv.com/mark, crtv.com/mark.
And that was actually not very good. I let it go because that was actually not what I had wanted.
Sign up there or give us a call at 844-LEVIN-TV, 844-LEVIN-TV.
This is not what I wanted. I am having the worst trouble trying to get back to the screen.
So let's start out with the basic.
Hello, America. I'm Mark Levin. This is
tied to this particular item, I'm afraid. I actually wanted an interview with Salim Mansour, who was supposed to be the Conservative Canada candidate in the upcoming November election in October election in the London, Ontario riding of London North Centre. Perhaps this will give it to us.
If we lose and if we are censored, which is what is happening, then we lose all our freedom, because free speech is the mother of all freedom.
By all accounts, Professor and author Salim Mansour has all the hallmarks of a star candidate for the Conservative Party of Canada. Dr. Mansour is an intellectual and has written extensively on a variety of topics, but alas, the Andrew Scheer Conservatives have disallowed the candidacy of Salim Mansour, meaning that Professor Mansour will not, contrary to expectations, be representing the party in a London, Ontario riding. Apparently, Mr. Scheer is antsy about Dr. Mansour's public criticism pertaining to radical Islam, and inexplicably, for having the temerity to call out the jihadis. This somehow makes Dr. Mansour the wrong kind of Muslim? Absolutely incredible. Joining me now from London is Salim Mansour, who only found out the other day that he is candidate non grata as far as Team Scheer is concerned, just for having the audacity to speak openly and honestly about radical Islam. Great to have you with us, Salim.
Thank you, David. Thank you for calling me.
Always a pleasure. So, as I alluded to in my intro, sir, it would appear that when it comes to Mr. Scheer, even when a Muslim such as yourself calls out the likes of the Muslim Brotherhood, this is an act of Islamophobia? How can this be, Salim?
Well, David, let whoever talk about Islamophobia first define what it is supposed to mean. And this is a whole different topic, but what has happened is that the leadership and the people around the leadership informed me by an email that they have disallowed my candidacy in London North Centre and that they provided in that area no reason. There was no indication of why they were doing this.
So if there is no indication, Salim, what do you think is the unspoken strategy of the conservatives in determining that they don't want you to be part of the team?
Well, David, that is the most interesting question, not only about the Conservative Party at the present time. I think that is a question that is a question for the whole country. I am a long-standing member of the Conservative Party, more than 30 years now. And the people in the Conservative Party right across the country, they know me, they have read me, and I think I have a lot of support and a lot of well-wishers. But why the leadership has done this, they have provided no reason. And I think the fact that they did not state why they are disallowing me is they don't want a paper trail of the reason for which they have disallowed me. I cannot speculate. It is up to them to come out and indicate to the public in London North Centre why the Conservative members of London North Centre who have been denied their right to choose their candidate in a fair democratic contest. I did not want, or nor did I sought, any preferential treatment. I filed my nomination paper more than 9 months ago. Last summer, I went through all the process. I was interviewed by the selection committee of the London North Centre EDA, and I think they reported my application favorably. And I never heard anything from Ottawa all of these 9 months until I got this email telling me that they have disallowed my candidacy.
And Salim, I can tell you, I've reached out to the Conservative Party to ask them for specific details. I've been met, again, with radio silence. But speaking of a paper trail, my personal view, Salim, and I might be wrong about this, but I don't think I am, I think Andrew Scheer is terrified that people in the, you know, his enemies, those in the media party that are not conservative will cherry pick certain comments, certain phrases from your columns, take them out of context and say, look at this man, look at this anti-Muslim rhetoric that he writes, which of course is ludicrous given that you yourself are Muslim, of course. And that's what I think is behind this, Salim. I just think that Andrew Scheer is so desperate to get the approval of those that, well, they don't like him now and they never like him, that he'll throw you under the bus if that's, you know, a means in achieving this. What do you think?
David, I'll speak to you now about the situation in the larger term. The specific question that you asked me, why Andrew Scheer and his people disallowed me, is up to speculation. So I will leave it to the people to come to their own conclusion. Because my views, my position is in the public. I was not writing as a conservative, I was writing in my capacity as a professor and a public intellectual and a nationally syndicated columnist for the Sun Media for 15 years.
Yes.
As a Canadian, who happens to be a Muslim, and all of my writing is in the public, and the public can, and that's what you're doing, David. You are talking to me now as Salim Mansur. And so now my answer to your question is, in the larger sense, is that since 9/11, the Western world is faced with a totalitarian movement that is global and that is engaged in violence. This violence was brought to North America on 9/11. But this violence and this totalitarian ideology has been plaguing the Muslim world for almost the entire 20th century. And now it has gone global. The whole irony is that our mainstream political parties have engaged in appeasing this global totalitarian movement that stands in complete opposition to the values that people like you and I cherish, defend. In my case, I have been defending and talking about before 9/11.
Yes.
And the issue is that we as Canadians are faced, that we need to talk and understand about this elephant in the room, in our room, which affects everything. It affects our way of life. It affects our liberal democracy. It affects our economy. And most fundamentally, it affects our security. We cannot talk about immigration, for instance, without taking into account the elephant in the room, that is Islamism and Islamists.
100%.
So I have spoken about it, but I'm a very small person. I'm just alone. And my voice is just limited to the people who have read me.
Well, Salim,
the Conservative Party knew that.
And speaking of
when
the Conservative,
I applied,
okay,
they saw all of my resume.
Yeah,
they had the entire list of my publication, of my books, of the awards I have won. So it was not that I was an unknown quantity, but they sat on my application for more than 9 months.
Yeah,
did not communicate with me. Did not discuss the issue, and then decided to disallow me.
Well, Salim, speaking of the Conservatives, an irony or perverse irony, what I find staggering is the fact that I go back to 2017, and Andrew Scheer raised a question in the House of Commons, a very fair, a very important question, about what is Canada going to be doing about Canadians who were fighting for ISIS overseas, returning to Canada. And you may remember this, Justin Trudeau got out and outrageously smeared Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives as being Islamophobes simply for asking this perfectly valid question. And now it would seem to me that Mr. Scheer has sampled the Kool-Aid. He's worried about being branded an Islamophobe, even based on the writings of someone of your stature, again, being twisted and taken out of context. I just find it stunning because that was an unfair smear to Mr. Scheer. It was outrageous. It was ludicrous. And yet, from what I read if I'm reading the tea leaves right, the Conservative Party is doing to you what Justin Trudeau and the Liberals did to Mr. Scheer 2 years ago. It's incredible, Salim.
Yes, it is incredible, because what has happened, David, the Liberal Party, Justin Trudeau, and the parties on the left, the NDP, the Greens, and all the people who have soaked up the ideology of the left, of the globalism that is in the academia and in the media. They have basically surrendered to the idea and narrative of the Muslim Brotherhood. And they are now pushing the Muslim Brotherhood ideology, Motion 103, Islamophobia, and everything else.
Salim, we just lost your picture there.
Phenomena was and is to silence any discussion of Islamism by branding anyone who discusses what is happening as a bigot, hence Islamophobia.
Salim, in addition to everything you just said,
all non-Muslims, especially the political elite, the academic elite, and the media elite in the Western world, has surrendered and fearful that they will be called bigots. That's what has happened. So we are losing our free speech. If we lose and if we are censored, which is what is happening, then we lose all our freedom, because free speech is the mother of all freedom.
Well, I would suggest that Mr. Scheer isn't that big on free speech. Salim, just last week I was in Ottawa to cover the Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights. This is the horse and pony show in which they're going to bring back Section 13 into the Canadian Human Rights Act. This is, of course, the pro-censorship, anti-free speech provision, something that in 2013 the Stephen Harper Conservatives rightfully eradicated. And yet, what do we have? We have Conservatives on that committee voting for it to be brought back. And to me, the world is upside down, because there's still dozens of Conservatives as part of Team Scheer that were there when it was Mr. Harper as Prime Minister. So in addition to the likes of M103, here we have Section 13 coming back. So I think that Mr. Scheer isn't all that big on freedom of speech. And if you talk about an item that resonates with a conservative base, certainly it's freedom of speech. So why is he going down this route, Salim?
David, I was in the thick of the battle to repeal Section 13.
Yeah.
I have a whole chapter in my book, Delectable Law, the Liberal Repudiation of Modern Socialism, on Section 13 of what Bernstein and Levan and others were engaged in, and in some way I was engaged in, and feel, or at least a part. Here is the issue. Once you begin to appease the crocodile, you end up being eaten by the crocodile.
Yeah. You know, well said.
There is no end to appeasement.
And you know, I think there's an example to back up your analogy, Salim. If you are not the so-called right kind of Muslim for the Conservative Party in the eyes of the hierarchy in Ottawa, then let's look who Andrew Scheer has been hobnobbing with recently. He was he had a photo op with Omar Subedar. This is that imam who's basically written the book on the proper ways in which to discipline and use physical force against your wife. Why in blue hell would Andrew Scheer want to hang with somebody like that, and yet a scholar like you, who calls it like it, like you see it, and it's the truth, is, like I said earlier, persona non grata? Again, I think this is an act of cowardice, and I think it's dangerous, quite frankly.
David, let us give, from my part, let me give you the best interpretation the most charitable interpretation, the most favorable interpretation of what you have defined. I think our conservative leader is uninformed. They don't know the subject. They don't know the history. They don't know the culture. And they have come to believe, which is a legacy or the consequence of multiculturalism, that you go to the ethnic community to get votes, and you go to the Sikh Gurdwara, the Hindu temple, and of course the Muslim mosque to get votes. This is the legacy of multiculturalism. Why do politicians in a secular liberal democracy head to the mosque to go and get votes?
Yeah.
Now, if you go to the mosque to get votes, then you are already compromised to basically hold the hands of the people who control the mosque.
Yeah.
95% of the mosques in Canada, in North America, are funded and run by offshore money coming from the Middle East. The people in the mosque are the agents and the loyalists to the Muslim Brotherhood ideology. I cannot go to the mosque in London.
Wow.
The reason I cannot go, because the mosque has given fatwa and have declared me a heretic and an apostate. I went to the mosque in Jerusalem. I prayed in Jerusalem, but I cannot go to the mosque in London. The greatest and the freest and the most liberal capital in the world for people of all religions is the capital of Israel.
You know,
our politician, as I said, once you begin appeasing, then there is no end to it. It is a simple geometrical logic. Once your premise, whatever is your premise in logic, is flawed, then the result will be flawed. It cannot be corrected.
You know, and one of the reasons why I say it's a dangerous road to travel down, Salim, is that, you know, you mentioned Israel and the freedom there, yet we have in many Western cities, including Toronto, the annual Al-Quds Day protest. And at the last one, more than a week ago, I interviewed a Muslim man. He said he was a U of T graduate in the sciences. And he was hopeful and actually expecting that one day Sharia law will replace Canadian law. And it's not Sharia law light. He was very gleeful that this would mean the execution of gay people in Canada. This is somebody in Toronto in 2019 saying this. It is absolutely astonishing. But Salim, we're running long on time. One last exit question. Now that the Conservative Party has cut ties with you, what is the future for Professor Mansour? Are you considering maybe running as an independent or as a member of the People's Party of Canada, or are you done with politics now?
No, one cannot be done with politics no more than one can be done with gravity. But where and what I'm going to do in terms of the 2019 election, we will make a decision. I will make a decision with my team. But here, David, if you have a minute, this is what I will say for now. My rights as a Canadian citizen and a member of the Conservative Party was taken away without any reason to contest a nomination contest. And the democratic rights of the Conservative members of London North Centre was taken away, and they were denied the right to choose their candidate to represent them in the 2019 election. We will have to remedy that.
Well, you know, Professor Mansour, I've stated what I believe and what I think is the truth. And all I can say as we wrap this up is that I think it's cowardly on the behalf of the Conservative Party. It's shameful. And ultimately, it is self-defeating. I think we see a very weak, timid leader stabbing himself, and it's going to be a death of a thousand cuts, self-inflicted, I may add, and in terms of taking an election that should be a sure thing for regime change, given all the scandals with the Liberal Party, and actually making it a horse race or giving another mandate to the Justin Trudeau Liberals. It's a tragedy, I think, we're watching unfold, and I'm so sorry that a star candidate like you is given the...
Oh, it's very, very interesting. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on lightresistanceradio.com. I'm going to take my musical break now. No break at all. I'll see you again tomorrow. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.